This is Audible.
The Camera Lies by A.B. Morgan. Narrated by Guy Mott. Chapter 1. Turning slowly, Conrad Neal faced the film crew and directed his words at the watching audience behind the large lens of the TV camera. If Matthew Hawley were a woman, would his sentence have been so harsh? The answer, in this case, is probably yes, for the simple fact that the level of premeditation could not in any way support the suggestion that he was of an unstable mind. Unbelievably, this was the case strongly argued by his barrister in court. But how on earth can we accept his story? Based on what we are about to show you, how is that possible? If you are of a delicate disposition, I strongly advise that you look away. What you will see next is graphic, brutal, and sickening. There was a momentary pause before a series of still color photographs appeared on the television monitor and were commented on in finite detail. Here we see the mutilated body of Helena Chorsten Hawley on the expensively tiled floor of her substantial kitchen. It is the morning of the 1st of March 2014, and her own blood surrounds her. The skid marks that we can see in the Lake of Red, we are told, were made by her husband, Matthew, as he carried out the deliberate surgical removal of certain appendages and organs. Not, as you would suppose, to make life easier for himself in the disposal of his wife's body, and not even to aid his attempt to hide her, because Matthew Hawley made no such attempt. He killed her, neatly laid out her remains, and dialed 999. He mutilated her, as is plain to see from these police photographs, by removing her eyes with the implement pictured to the left of her head. The eyeballs are on the right, on the floor amongst the blood, and quite difficult to distinguish. The order in which these disfigurements were carried out is not known. But we have to ask ourselves, why would he do that at all? Why did he cut off her breasts? And bizarrely, why did he make careful incisions to remove her lips? The camera cut back to a shot of Conrad leaning forward earnestly as he sat to one side of a functional desk in a prison interview room, where the stark grey walls contributed to the slightly hollow sound when he spoke. Welcome to another case of The Truth Behind the Lies, with me, Conrad Neal. Over the 4 days that I interviewed Matthew Hawley, here at HMP Longlees, I have probed into the unbelievable chain of events that led to the brutal murder of his beautiful wife. If what he has told me is the truth, it does not change that one simple fact. Matthew Hawley did murder his wife, Helena Chorsten Hawley. He remains guilty of a heinous crime, and he accepts that. So why are we here if there has been no miscarriage of justice? I'll leave you to decide for yourselves, once you've heard what he has to say. Conrad leant back in his chair with his hands together, as if in prayer, placing the tips of his fingers to his lips. The scene changed, although the room remained the same. Sitting on a plain plastic chair was a slim, almost gaunt Matthew Hawley.
"Yep, I'm happy with how the intro is looking, Conrad. What do you think?"
asked Annette, the editor, as they sat together with two other members of the production team, beginning an initial run of the material recorded by Conrad and the film crew at the prison. The first thing that had struck Conrad about Matthew Hawley was that the greying hair and prison pallor could not belie the man's underlying distinctly handsome features. A strong jaw, chiselled nose, intense but alluring green eyes, and not a tattoo in sight. His modest, intelligent air, coupled with his good looks, shattered the stereotypes that could potentially define him as a monstrous killer. When Matthew spoke, he did so with consideration, careful with his choice of words, but he didn't shy away from answering questions. He was believable.
"Yeah, good. I guess we can get hold of a recording of Matthew's call to the emergency services if we need to make use of it. but overall I'm comfortable that our outline plan is a sensible order of events. Goodness me, he comes across frighteningly well on film.
Doesn't he just? You know, watching this and transcribing every word freaked me out quite a bit, I can tell you.
Annette brushed cake crumbs from her enormous trouser-clad thighs. She hadn't stopped eating so far that morning, and this was irritating Conrad, who had to suffer the endless moaning about her weight, for which she blamed her thyroid. His own eating habits were overshadowed by the constant fear of putting on the pounds. The slightest weight gain would be magnified in front of the television cameras where he earned his living, when he wasn't writing newspaper columns or fronting chat shows. He had thought his best days were behind him as far as fame and fortune in the fickle world of television was concerned, but his move into documentary and real crime had reignited the nation's interest in what he had to say.
"I can't believe how lucky we were to get the green light on this one. It's a hell of a story,"
Annette said as she stood up, gently patting the presenter's designer-dressed shoulder.
"Great interview. Do you realise he could be your younger brother? In appearance, I mean. Similar features. You make quite an attractive pair, which will please our female audience members, I'm sure. What would you say? There are 5 years or so between you and Matthew Hawley? Good-looking man. But shit, I can't quite comprehend what sick and twisted stuff he told you, you know. So what do you want to do now?"
Annette turned to ask her team.
"Shall we let it roll as usual and get this firmly into our heads before we finally identify the selects?"
A young intern, by the name of Joe, bravely interrupted to ask what that turn of phrase meant.
"Slow, Joe, you didn't do your homework. Otherwise you would know what the selects are."
Annette had been ironic in nicknaming him Slow Joe. Conrad knew that she was impressed by how swiftly an enthusiastic Joe absorbed information and by the intelligence with which he used the latest sound technology.
"Actually, that's a fair question, Joe,"
Conrad interjected before Annette had a chance to enlighten her protégé. "The art and craft of producing, and especially editing a documentary, is entirely different from a fiction film. Although there's a chronology to the interview itself, it has to be edited with the viewer in mind. We don't change what has been said, but we do develop a working structure and identify scenes, ideas, thoughts that can be separated out. The selects. We can trim the long pauses or the repetition of the same argument. Do you see?" Joe mouthed his thanks and received a thumbs up in return. Annette had obviously decided to ignore the interruption, and she continued without needing to contribute to the response.
"This transcript's a long one. Mind you, having looked at it again, I'm beginning to think we have enough juicy, solid material to make a two-parter, and I'm loath to bin anything. What's your feeling, guys?"
"I don't think we can argue for two episodes of the same case," Conrad replied. "The executives won't agree to a change in the fundamentals of the contract. So let's watch and aim to eventually edit to the required 60 minutes. I can precise certain parts to camera if necessary, or as voiceover material during those odd shots around the prison that we bagged. It'll provide atmosphere and break up the face-to-face sections."
The assistant editor, Mike, signalled his approval. Conrad was explaining in more detail than was strictly necessary just for Slow Joe's educational benefit.
"To be frank with you, this one's had me awake at nights ever since we started filming. I wasn't expecting to like Matthew Hawley, but he's so bloody convincing on camera, and the viewers are in for a rough ride when they see and hear what he has to say. I wanted to hate him, but I couldn't. Anyway, let's crack on before the coffee gets cold."
Chapter 2 Conrad waited patiently for Matthew Hawley's reply to his first question. When it came, he sensed the pain and anger in the words, although the man sitting in front of him appeared to be focused and in control of his body language.
"My legal representatives didn't fabricate an unbelievable story, as you suggest, Mr. Neal. What I told them was the truth. most of which was deemed inadmissible. How the evidence was perceived and twisted by the prosecution made the truth appear to be a lie.
But you must be aware, Matthew, that what the public heard during your trial was that you had a fantastic life with a beautiful, kind-hearted woman who worshipped and doted on you. She even accepted your son to live with you both. You were a phenomenally well-off family, and willing to share that wealth, you raised thousands of pounds for charity. When you have a life of stable privilege, it simply doesn't make sense that you would murder your wife.
Conrad left a 3-second pause before asking his question.
What can you say to help us understand why you snapped and killed her? Did you snap?
He couldn't read, Matthew. He could usually pitch his questions in a particular way by watching for signs of discomfort in his interviewee. But Matthew Hawley was giving nothing away. The man was distant, cut off, but not aloof.
I didn't snap, Mr. Neal. That much is obvious.
I see your point. Of course, it can't have been impulsive or an act of self-defense. You took your time to mutilate Helena, and from what we have seen from the evidence, there appears to have been a reason behind how you laid out her body. Tell us then, if you would, how you came to the decision to kill your wife. Try to build a picture that will serve to detail the events leading to your actions 2 years ago, when you deliberately killed and mutilated Helena.
Mr. Neal, I believe that is what we agreed. I'm happy to recount my story because this is for my son. I want, above everything else, for him to hear and know the truth that the court failed to examine. But please don't expect me to tell you in gory detail every incision I made.
Your son, Josh, was how old when you left your first marriage?
Let's straighten out the facts, Mr. Neal. I did not leave. Amy had an affair, and I went through the painful process of a divorce, being obliged to leave the home I had worked so hard to build for my family. Instead of a contented life, I had my heart broken. I vowed to do whatever I had to in order to keep alive the relationship with my son, who was only 12. Unlike my ex-wife and her exaggerated claims of irreconcilable differences, I remained adult and compliant with Amy's wishes in order to keep the peace. Somehow I even learnt to tolerate Pete the Wanker. No apology for referring to him in that way. The bloke is a twat, and I still hate him for decimating my family. If you have to cut that bit, then so be it. But he's still a wanker.
Conrad was supposed to be listening hard to pick up a cue for his next question. He didn't worry about the fruity language, as it made for a gritty edge to the documentary, and revealed a small glimmer of emotion breaking through from Matthew Hawley's well-guarded inner feelings. Instead of concentrating on the words being spoken, he had found himself wondering which idiot researcher had got the facts wrong about Matthew Hawley's first marriage, and in doing so, he almost missed the opportunity for a swift winning question. Almost.
Can I ask you to think back to that time and explain to me why you didn't kill your first wife, Amy, or her new lover, Peter? You say they decimated your family, and it sounds like a desperate time for you. So why not kill them?
Matthew sighed. I'm not a serial killer, Mr. Neal. I was an ordinary man whose wife did the dirty, and I had to live with the consequences of not paying her enough attention. She wasn't the only one at fault. Just because I speak my mind about hating what they did, doesn't mean I would kill them.
What made you kill your second wife, then, if a painful divorce and betrayal wasn't enough to drive you to any sort of violent reaction? What did? Conrad had floundered. He hadn't expected Matthew Hawley to be so grounded, rational, and implacable.
The best psychopath I've ever met, he decided.
Annette piped up. Stop there a second. Where were you going with these opening questions, Con? You let him sidetrack you. I think we may have to cut that bit of waffle. Scoot through to the question about first meeting Helena.
The editing suite was silent again, as they identified the moment Matthew began the details of his relationship with the woman he would eventually kill.
We met through a dating site, yes. I know, not romantic or original these days, but I'd avoided any form of relationship for at least 2 years after my divorce from Amy. I focused on Josh, and we had loads of good times together every Saturday afternoon. We played football, went roller skating, fishing, that type of boys' stuff. It was great, and I enjoyed time with Josh. But I'm human after all, and hankered for female company that was a bit more meaningful than a quick bang with the barmaid at the Bird in Hand.
The interview, with the cameras rolling, became more of a natural conversation as the two men settled into the rhythm of the story. Matthew's facial features had relaxed as he spoke, remembering with fondness the ties together with his only son.
Whose idea was it to try internet dating?
Gary at work.
He's a bit of a wag on the surface, but he's a nice bloke who eventually convinced himself that I was heading for eternal solitude and blindness due to nights playing with myself.
Conrad chuckled.
It was Gary who helped with the wording on the application for one of those dating sites for professional singles, and we tinkered about with photos on my phone, trying to make me look macho and confident. Anyway, it worked. I had at least 3 disastrous dates before I met Helena.
Matthew rubbed his hands up and down the length of his thighs before being able to continue. Knowing Matthew didn't react like that when he spoke about Amy and his divorce, Conrad made a mental note to check with the editing team whether that moment was clear to see on film. Matthew gave a short cough before he recommenced.
She was an absolute stunner. I remember we'd agreed to meet at Gino's, an Italian restaurant. We'd chatted online about everyday mundane nonsense, you know. Books we'd read, sports we enjoyed, and food, which is why we settled on Italian for dinner. I'd promised faithfully to arrive early, because she said she was worried about turning up on her own and being left in the lurch. So I made sure I was there, sitting at a small table facing the door, and I happened to be chatting to the waiter about, I can't think now, the weather probably. When Helena walked in, my heart sank.
Did it? Why?
Conrad asked without hesitation.
Because there was no way a woman like her was going to find a man like me the least bit attractive. I was fit and healthy, all right, but not your toned, tanned beefcake. And I wasn't wealthy or powerful, either. I didn't stand a chance. All the aphrodisiacs were missing.
Annette paused the run-through in the editing room.
Do we have that photo of Matthew from when he was first dating Helena? Having sight of that will give the audience a better idea of how much change he went through, from the exercise regimes and the surgery. Don't you agree? Let's make a note of that, then. Good.
Slow Joe put the digital photo of Matthew Hawley on the computer screen in front of them, and Conrad shook his head in disbelief.
Christ! He looked like a different man back then.
When was this taken?
The date says 12th of April 2013.
Bloody hell. What a difference between that photo and the photo of him with Helena at the charity gala a year later. Have we got that one to hand, Joe?
Conrad asked, intrigued by the contrast between the pictures. After some mouse-clicking, Joe managed to get the images side by side on one of the 3 screens.
Save that, please, Joe,
demanded Annette, who, like Conrad, was staring at the monitor in awe.
The nose job is amazing! Look at the difference in his physical shape. He must have spent hours in the gym to get like that.
Nice teeth. They're definitely expensive. Now look at her. Look at Helena in those pictures. Are you seeing what I'm seeing? Asked Conrad.
The other 2 men in the room nodded emphatically, but Annette shook her head.
No. What about her?
Her tits have got to be 2 sizes bigger at least.
Are you sure? They can't be plastic. They look too real. It could be the camera angle, or a better bra. But look at her mouth. See? Fewer lines. Botox, probably. Nice lips. She's a beauty, there's no doubt about that.
Was a beauty.
Yes. You're right on several counts. We'll use these contrasting pictures for sure. Nice work. Thanks, Joe. Take a note of the time code at that section, would you? What a lovely soundbite from Matthew. I didn't stand a chance. All the aphrodisiacs were missing.
Joe looked around, as if searching for someone else called Joe. But once it dawned that Annette had paid him a compliment, he beamed across at Conrad for confirmation. Following the pause in proceedings, the team returned to the task in hand. Watching and making notes about the interviews with Matthew Hawley in HMP Longleys, Conrad could recall every minute, and as he watched the playbacks, he relived and analysed each moment. On the screen, he was seen smiling amiably at Matthew. That was your view, but it seems, from the evidence, that Helena must have found something attractive about you, because you had a whirlwind of a courtship leading swiftly to marriage 6 months later. Most people would say you landed on your feet there, Matthew. Helena Chorston was a wealthy lady, so she wasn't looking for your money. She ran her own successful business and was a bright, intelligent woman by all accounts. What was it she found in you, do you think?
A sex toy.
Pardon?
Conrad sat back in his chair, pulling away from Matthew in surprise.
What the hell? Where did that reply come from?
He didn't say that in court.
There wasn't much mention of that specific side of your relationship during your trial, so I find myself wondering why you've just made that comment.
You're right. Helena didn't need money, but she was attracted to my vulnerability and potential to be the man she wanted in her life. What she needed was my obedience, my loyalty, and undivided attention to make her life complete. I'm not an idiot, but because she took her time to win my affections, she made certain, once I had fallen for her, that I couldn't bear to leave.
Why do you think that was?
Matthew took his time to find the right words. Absolute and overriding dread of rejection was her driving force. Only with hindsight can I see that she continually tested my devotion to alleviate her fears, although I'm sure any good psychologist could tell you that if they cared to examine the right evidence. I didn't understand her motives at the time, but I wouldn't have wanted to leave. She gave me everything. You need to understand, Mr. Neal, that Helena was amazing. When I first met her, I thought I'd died and gone to heaven.
Conrad couldn't help himself. As he watched the interview in the editing suite, he thought of his own wife, Delia, and began to drift into a reverie. God, she was the sexiest bitch I'd ever had the pleasure of bedding. Those were the days when we first dated, shagging anywhere and everywhere, legs up to her armpits and the best tits in town. Nowadays, sex has to be booked into Delia's diary, and it's a rare treat.
There's a good boy. Thanks for the new earrings. If you really insist on a quick one, do it now before I have to get ready to go to book club. I can spare 5 minutes. Help yourself and don't make a mess.
It took determined mental focus to shake himself back into paying attention to the monitor screens before him and to Matthew's words.
Chapter 3
Sex was the carrot she dangled in front of me. She was good at it. Really good. You have to remember, Mr. Neal, that I'd chosen to be without a regular relationship for nigh on 2 years, and to have a woman who resembled a 1950s pin-up girl in my arms was a miracle. Helena had an hourglass figure, not flat, thin and scrawny. She was soft and womanly, and smelt amazing. I'm not a lover of strong perfumes, and in my view, stacks of cosmetics slapped on a woman makes her look cheap, whoever she may be. Helena had it right. A subtle smell of perfume always greeted me as I nuzzled her neck, with enough makeup on to accentuate her eyes and make her lips seem moist and inviting. Sounds too good to be true, doesn't it?
Conrad had to agree. Yes, it does.
It was. And for the first few months I walked around in a permanent state of sexual excitement. It was blissfully excruciating, and exactly what she wanted to achieve. Helena would look at me across a room full of people when we attended those endless charity functions, and she would only have to run her tongue across her lips to have me dribbling. Don't get me wrong. I wasn't bought that easily. You see, I didn't trust her to begin with. Let's face it. I was having a good time, but there was no way I was contemplating a long-term relationship with a woman who most men would give their eye teeth for. In my mind, she would be off with the first Adonis that caught her attention. Conrad sympathized with Matthew's assessment of the situation.
Divorce can have that effect, can't it? That lack of trust. Still, she didn't seem to be interested in other men, did she? From what was described in the evidence to the court at your trial, almost the opposite occurs. She builds a life with you and around your needs.
Sitting watching in the editing suite, Conrad had vivid recall of this part of the interview. He had become determined to catch Matthew out, to trip him up by finding any inconsistency in his story of the events. But as hard as he tried to keep his focus on teasing the next fact from Matthew, he couldn't stop picturing the luscious Helena. Watching the interview again, he was caught in the same trap.
I'm turning into a filthy, lascivious, middle-aged tosser. What's wrong with me? I shouldn't have been imagining my head between her boobs. She's a dead woman, for Christ's sake.
It appears that she built her life around me. That's the impression she wanted everyone to see. You're right. She focused on me, and she built trust by creating dependence. Let me try to explain. With Amy, I hadn't taken enough time to be with her and do things together. We'd allowed our lives to drift apart, and I spent too many hours at work. Even so, I never thought she would cheat, and that was crushing. Helena spent time with me. We had a lot in common. Music, film, a love of the outdoors, and she had a sharp mind. The more conversations we had, the more she gained an understanding of my insecurities, my underlying fears, likes, dislikes, and she also lavished presents on me, not just sex, but treats and gifts, as I did for her. We did things together for fun, and she made me laugh.
I'm sorry, Matthew, but that sounds to me as if what you had was a normal, healthy relationship.
Yes, I know it does. And it was normal and healthy until small things started to happen to change the balance of power. She worked hard to help me build trust, and once she had that, I was hers to do with as she pleased. Matthew pointed to the desk at which Conrad was sitting. You have an iPhone. Then you'll understand what I'm talking about. We used Find Friends to keep track of each other, and it helped to identify where she was. I could press a button and have confirmation that she was at home in her office, at the hairdresser's, having her nails done, or having coffee with a client. Helena took the time to meet my work colleagues by coming along to a couple of evening socials with my team and their other halves, and I had regular contact with her staff.
Tell me about them.
Helena's. There were only two of them. Naomi and Richard. Richard was quite young, but he had been with Helena since he'd left school, and he'd lodged in the upstairs flat above the offices. Lovely chap. Hard-working. Efficient, but quiet. Naomi joined the business a year or so before I came on the scene. She and Helena were like two peas in a pod. More like best friends than a work relationship, I would say. Their offices were in a separate annex to our main house. so as far as work was concerned, they didn't interfere with our private lives. Not in the beginning, anyway.
What about your family? How did that work?
Helena came with me to meet Josh within a month of our first date, and eventually she met Amy, which wasn't as awkward as I expected. Without me interfering, they seemed to be able to negotiate when Josh would spend time with us, and as the weeks went by, Helena organized really brilliant days out. She seemed to instinctively understand that being 14, Josh was at the most treacherous age, and so she didn't try too hard with him. Initially, she tagged along with our boys' adventures or left us to it. You can't imagine the relief when it became obvious how well Josh had taken to Helena. You're right. It was normal and healthy. Even when she asked me to move in with her, it felt right. We talked about the pros and cons, and agreed how we would manage our relationship and seeing Josh. The things I worried about.
Where were you living at the time?
I'd been staying with Gary as a lodger, and it was great. Two blokes in their 30s, drinking, watching sport on the TV, and even shagging occasionally. Not each other, you understand. Do you remember the series on TV, Men Behaving Badly? It was the same setup. But you can't go on like that forever if you want to be taken seriously. And I had a decent career. Once the maintenance money was paid, I actually had enough left to think about buying somewhere. A small house of my own.
Conrad interrupted. Just to check the facts here, Matthew, if I can. You were a marketing consultant for a well-known company who provide medical and surgical equipment for hospitals. Is that correct?
He looked down to a clipboard lying on the desk to his left.
You had a company car and earned around 80 grand a year with bonuses. That's an exceptionally good income.
Yes, it was. Out of which I had to pay an extortionately high amount of maintenance to my ex-wife, despite the fact that Pete the Wanker had moved in with Amy as soon as the divorce was settled. I'd paid off the mortgage, everything. Try it yourself sometime. It's like being robbed.
The challenge didn't go unrecognized. I don't intend to find out.
Annette gave a snort as she turned.
What did you have to make a personal comment for? We'll have to cut that. You know the rules.
No sooner were the words out of his mouth, he knew he'd made a mistake in rising to the bait. Matthew had been testing him out, and he'd failed to recognize the fact until it was too late. Subconsciously, Conrad looked down at his crotch, as he thought about how he'd practically had to pay his own wife for the privilege of sex in recent years. As his popularity with the viewing public had waned, so had his wife's interest in him. Unfortunately, without a bunch of expensive flowers, a dinner date, or jewellery as a bribe, she didn't seem to find him enough of a turn-on to bother with. Mrs. Delia Neal had expensive tastes, and therefore, with the thought of the astronomical cost of legal proceedings, the public humiliation, and the negative impact on his future career, the idea of divorce had barely ever crossed Conrad's mind. He'd had extramarital flings to fill the void, and he'd fallen in love with his last, until Delia had put a stop to that. But until he had started his series of interviews with Matthew Hawley, he hadn't thought about whether he truthfully wanted to spend the rest of his life married to Delia and pandering to her requirements. Every evening in the last 3 months, he had made a point of purchasing a gift to his wife to buy back her affections, even if his only reward was a soft touch, a kiss on the cheek, or the occasional brief, lackluster coital encounter. He was so sexually frustrated, he'd had to lower himself to these degrading bribery tactics. This was inescapable. It was Delia who had marketed them as a golden couple to keep their public profile alive, landing him advertising jobs and voiceovers. Her PR efforts eventually served to resurrect his place in the affections of the public and the television producers. He owed it to his wife, and she knew it. Delia was also well aware that he'd had a wandering eye for years, and that his most recent affair had threatened their business-like partnership. She put a stop to that.
and thus, inevitably, the price paid for fame and celebrity was a private life so dreadfully dull that only desperation to hold on to his career remained as the sole impetus enabling him to return home at the end of the day. He was now wallowing in the realization that his decision to patch up his marriage 3 months previously to salvage his career had been disastrous. He had behaved like a shallow, selfish bastard, and he could barely look in the mirror each morning without being disgusted at the man he had become. Chapter 4. If you were planning on buying your own house, why did you agree to move in with Helena? Conrad asked Matthew, genuinely puzzled as to why that decision had been made.
I told you, it was impossible for me not to be with her. The thought of sex on tap was too much for my feeble mind to argue with. Besides which, Helena ran her office from home, and it made sense for me to move in there. But for her own reasons, she didn't give me a set of keys until I had proved myself.
Are you saying that you had to ring the doorbell to gain entry to the house? Had you forgotten to pay your bed and board money?
He was sceptical, as was reflected in the tone of his question. Matthew held his gaze. It was only for a matter of days. Actually, I'd set up a joint account with Helena, and we used it to pay bills. So please don't mistake me for a freeloader. I paid my way, Mr. Neal, more than you'll ever imagine. She dangled the house keys in the same way that she dangled her sexual enticements. There were to be long lines of special challenges and rewards that Helena had in mind. The first was designed as a surprise. I was so excited. Like a puppy, Mr. Neal. And I couldn't do enough for that woman. Believe me, she did everything for my benefit, short of wiping my arse. On the day, she outlined how I was to earn my own set of house keys. She sat me down and handed me a card, properly printed, about A5 size, and on it was a description of the surprise she had arranged for me. Skydiving.
Okay, that sounds exciting.
Not if you're petrified of heights, it doesn't. It gets better. She filmed me with her phone to capture my reaction to the surprise, and continued videoing as she handed me another card. This one confirmed that Helena had pledged to make a £5,000 donation to cancer research.
I see. Conrad smiled appreciatively towards Matthew.
No, you don't see. My parents died of cancer within a month of each other in the same year that I was divorced from Amy, and I'd been raising small amounts by doing fun runs at the weekends. Helena's pledge was astounding, and her thoughtfulness made me break down in tears. Embarrassing as it was, she filmed me crying like a child. I didn't suspect a thing.
But you agreed, and did the skydive?
Of course. I had 2 sleepless nights to get used to the idea before the actual jump. And somehow, I managed to convince Helena that it had been exhilarating, and the best thrill ride of my life. The sad truth was that I had been petrified the whole time, but as promised, I was handsomely rewarded with a set of my own house keys, a donation to a charity close to my heart, and shortly after landing, at the back of the aircraft hangar building, I was treated to hot, risky outdoor sex against a wall and confirmation of the date of our wedding. I was over the moon, Mr. Neal, not just because of that, but because she wanted to meet with Josh to tell him about the wedding plans personally, and she even insisted that if Josh was not happy, then we would postpone until he was.
Annette stopped the playback.
Con, do we really need this soppy sentimental stuff?
Have you read the whole transcript? You have. I know you have because you wrote the bloody thing. In which case, you must have missed the relevance of exploring the special thrilling treats that Matthew was being given. Anyway, we said we'd watch the whole thing again, make notes, and get this into our heads. Can we please stick to the plan? Conrad had heard what was about to be revealed over the next hours and days of the editing, and he was unable to emphasize enough the importance of retaining the integrity of the whole interview.
No cuts, not in the first run. Tell you what, shall we stop for lunch? I think we could all do with sustenance and a comfort break.
Nobody argued with him, and the three men left Annette to secure the door.
Back in an hour. A walk in the park is called for,
Conrad snapped, distracted by a personal quandary, fueled by the interview rerun. He didn't crave food. He needed to hide away in selfish misery to deal with his inner turmoil. Sitting on the park bench, he played with his mobile phone, moving his fingers across it, pressing the contacts button and then reverting back to the main screen. He was wearing a shabby baseball cap to hide his face. Despite having a particular dislike for that particular type of headwear, he had to take some precaution against being recognized if he wanted time for quiet contemplation in a public place.
"What have I done?" he said aloud to a passing squirrel.
Prodding a finger onto the tiny phone keyboard, he formulated a message.
"Lorna, I can't do it. I can't live without you. Bollocks to my public profile. Bollocks to everything. Please. Please let me see you, and I beg you to forgive me. K. Kiss kiss."
Not giving himself time to cancel the words, he pressed the send button, hoping that his self-inflicted broken heart could be mended. He waited. A reply arrived moments before he was due back in the editing room. "You either haven't read my letter, or you haven't received it." This was from a phone number that Conrad didn't recognize.
"Lorna, is that you?"
"No. Who is Lorna? Has she made you sad? You look so dejected." He scanned around him, trying to spot a familiar face. "Who's messing me about?" Nearby there was an elderly couple walking their equally ancient West Highland Terrier, a young mother with a baby in a pram, a middle-aged man cycling past, three people on the next bench along eating sandwiches and snacks for lunch, and dozens of people meandering around for as far as he could see. He decided to ignore the message. Time was slipping by, necessitating a coffee stop on the way past the street kiosk on the corner of the main road. Nothing was heard from Lorna. A dispirited soul, he plodded back into the uninspiring high-rise building where he would be incarcerated for the foreseeable future. Every editing workday he was welcomed by two receptionists who never seemed to tire of greeting staff and answering the phone. On re-entering his workplace, through the automatic revolving door, he took off his cap and smiled at the immaculately coiffured uniformed pair behind the desk. Lillian picked up the ringing phone.
"Good afternoon, Marriott and Westerns. How may I help you?"
she chirped. Her colleague George had a poorly disguised crush on Conrad.
"Good afternoon, Mr. Neil. I hope you've had the most amazing lunch break."
George was incredibly camp. He flirted unashamedly with men and women alike and got away with it. Conrad found him amusing and was always cheered by Gorgeous George, as he was affectionately known amongst the office staff.
"Not quite up to the usual standard, George, I have to say."
Conrad raised his coffee cup.
"I didn't quite manage to eat anything. A business call. You know how it is. But thanks for your concern. I don't suppose I could trouble you to order a Caesar salad from Poncho's Deli around the corner, could I?"
"Ooh, I'd be delighted. I'll deliver it to you personally, Mr. Neil. Give me 5 minutes."
"I know you'd love 5 minutes with me, young man, but I don't swing your way."
He watched, entertained, as George minced from behind the reception desk, took the £20 note offered by Conrad, brushing his fingers on purpose as he did so, before prancing towards the door.
"Lillian, I shall return forthwith once I have completed a most urgent mission for the lovely Mr. Neil."
Lillian acknowledged this with a wave. She was still chatting on the phone, repeating the phrase,
"Yes, I see,"
peppered with the occasional,
"Oh, dear."
She gestured to Conrad by raising one finger, and handed him a registered letter as he headed for the lifts while resurrecting his flattened hat hair, smiling to himself.
You say the skydive was the first of many special events, but the impression we have of you and Helena is that you willingly organized charitable fundraising activities and you raised tens of thousands of pounds. Are you saying that these formed a systematic plan of Helena's making? Matthew replied with impatience.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. Don't you see? Helena had me cornered. Cancer research is a noble cause, and one which was part of my grieving process for my parents, so I was hardly going to refuse. But as you will no doubt have noticed, the events were all organized by Helena and Naomi, but carried out by me. The abseiling was next on the list. Then came the bloody wing-walking.
As Matthew recalled the order of his challenges, he counted them on his fingers.
I've no idea how I didn't throw up. This is where you've missed the central motive of Helena's actions, Mr. Neal. She would offer me a number of rewards, which would be in the form of money to cancer research, adoration from my son for being heroic in his eyes, and a direct physical treat for me. Once I had completed a challenge, whatever it was, we would pose for the obligatory publicity shots, and having promised me a kinky thrill as a reward, she would delay our return home, or drive me insane with frustration by flirting with me. Sometimes, even when we did get home, she would sit me on a chair and walk naked in front of me, not letting me touch her until I was about to explode. Do you understand?
Conrad desperately wanted to hear the details, but knew that would be for his own guilty pleasure and wouldn't help to reduce the fantasies in his mind that were tormenting him. He changed the subject before embarrassing himself on camera. You mentioned the publicity shots. Were they the reason you both had your looks enhanced?
Matthew glanced towards the floor before he answered. That's a yes and a no. It began as a treat for us. Helena told me to take the day off work one Friday. It was July or August, I think. Helena woke me on the morning of that day and, as predicted, gave me one of her surprise cards, which had by then begun to fill me with dread. However, by way of an unexpected change, she'd arranged a whole day at a health spa.
Chapter 5.
Conrad inclined his head, encouraging Matthew to continue. He had decided to let the story flow. There was something in Matthew's tone of voice indicating the importance of this particular reference.
It was just what we needed.
Helena had booked us into a swanky spa hotel for the night because we had a charity zipwire event to attend the next afternoon. The hotel was about halfway there. Josh was taking part in the sponsored junior event, and he met us there with a couple of his mates. If I remember rightly, he had a lift from one of the other dads. The zipwire was an enormous long death slide across a rock-strewn valley, one of those new adventure attractions for the ultimate thrill-seekers and adrenaline junkies. Helena and Naomi, with their magical powers of persuasion, had negotiated with the owners to publicize the opening of Europe's second biggest zipwire by having a charity event. We dressed up as superhero characters and launched ourselves down the almighty wire. The boys loved the experience. I hated every minute. My fear of heights had worsened with each event, but I had at least learned to put the terror aside until the moment of no return. Even so, it was petrifying. On the drive to the spa, Helena and I talked about wedding plans. That discussion continued throughout most of the day, as we made final decisions on music, confirmed the number of guests, talked about the honeymoon, the usual endless organizational nightmare that had dominated our waking hours. She had a clear idea in her head of how she wanted our special day to unfold, and initially I went along for the ride. It was to be her day. Our parents were dead, and I only had distant cousins and Josh as family. The rest of my guests would be friends from work, Josh's gang of spotty mates, and my old university pals, so it didn't matter to me,
as long as Helena was happy. It was a wonderful time at the spa, although there was one unsettling incident that has played on my mind ever since.
Go on.
We'd been chatting in the steam room as Helena went into the finest details of the arrangement, and to be honest, I had tuned out. The last lady had just left the spa area, probably sick to death of hearing about flowers and table settings. Anyway, I found myself disagreeing with Helena about the scale of the plans. I didn't want a fuss, and yet she was describing this great lavish affair with a horse-drawn carriage, chandeliers, a full orchestra and a dress of biblical proportions. I didn't remember agreeing to what sounded like a ludicrously expensive and ostentatious affair. That's not my style. When I broached the subject, she reacted as if I had made a vicious attack on her dreams, which I probably had, and, as a result, she stormed out of the sauna, heading back towards the jacuzzi in a magnificent sulk. I sat silently for a matter of seconds before shouting my apology to her, and after sufficient begging, she stepped reluctantly from the hot tub and back towards the sauna in the corner of the room. She made mocking faces at me through the small pane of glass in the sauna door, making me promise that she could have whatever she wanted for our wedding. I caved in without an ounce of resistance. What was the point? Then she said she couldn't open the door. Or she pretended that she couldn't.
"You don't expect us to believe that, do you?" Conrad said impassively.
"You can decide for yourself. It's my observations and my perspective. For all I know, the door was stuck, but the expression on Helena's face was of pleasure, not concern as she held the handle. She could easily have had her foot against the bottom of the door, so I thought she was messing about at first. Which is what she said had happened. It was only after I collapsed that she went for help. She said the alarm hadn't worked. The manager came back with her, and they freed me without too much trouble, apparently. I'd passed out."
"You weren't angry?"
"Not at the time. I thought it was an accident."
A doubtful look crossed the interviewer's face. "I see. So what was next on Helena's itinerary?"
"Over carrots and quiche, she informed me what was in store for the rest of the day. In brief, I had to endure the spa treatments of medieval torture to earn my reward. While Helena had her nails done, I had my eyebrows shaped and my nose hair removed. That really makes your eyes water, I can assure you, Mr. Neal." After which, she revealed my next hair removal experience.
"All involving wax?"
"You've got it. Back, sack and crack, the next one was called."
Conrad winced in sympathy as Matthew continued his description of events.
"Good God! No man should have to endure that indignity. But it pleased Helena so much she squealed with delight at my protests and manly screams. The result was fascinating to her. Which led to her suggestion about plastic surgery and veneers for my teeth. Just rhinoplasty and new teeth. That's all I had done. The rest was my own hard work. She'd had me pounding away in the gym at home, and I have to say I was pleased with the results. The more toned I became, the more attractive Helena seemed to find me, so it was a win-win situation."
"I'm still puzzled. Why did you agree to something as drastic as plastic surgery, Matthew? You seem like a reasonable man, a bloke's bloke, who likes a beer and a night out with the lads. So why would you agree?"
"I didn't at first. But that's where I began to lose myself."
"Hold it there, please."
Annette confronted Conrad again.
"This drags on too long. It's way too lovey-dovey and poor man needs sex, don't you think? Now, having said that, I like the phrase he uses here. That's where I began to lose myself. So can we make a record of that, please?"
Annette, clearly not content with having had lunch, was now devouring a packet of chocolate digestives that she was dunking in her coffee and selfishly hadn't offered one to anyone else. Conrad had finished his salad and risked being given a slap on his wrist as he could resist no longer, and helped himself to a biscuit. Annette scowled at him as he offered the packet to Slow Joe, and then to Mike, who hardly ever expressed a controversial opinion in case he offended his colleagues in the production team. Instead, he worked silently and diligently to earn the reward of approval from Annette, the undisputed queen of the editing suite. The afternoon had been uninspiring, apart from the dramatic entrance from Gorgeous George, who had them in fits of giggles for a few precious minutes. George had caused a stir in Poncho's deli when he had decided to buy a treat for his colleague Lillian.
"She's partial to sticky cakes and puddings, and there was a special offer on. I spoke to the lady who was serving, and she was happy to sort out a takeaway salad for you, Mr. Neil. And then I got my words in a muddle, and I asked her for a stiffy, cocky pudding with cream for Lillian. I didn't know where to put myself. Anyway, Lillian knew where to put it. Know what I mean?"
George had then swanned out, leaving a cloud of aftershave in his wake. "That boy should be on the stage." "How did you lose yourself?" Conrad asked, following the hook.
At first, the suggestion of plastic surgery was ludicrous to me. I'm not that vain, but when I declined, Helena became really upset. She turned my argument around, reacting as if I had offended her by rejecting her idea.
"You don't want to be more attractive to me?"
It wasn't a moment of slight offence, Mr. Neil. She shunned me for days. So eventually, I did what she wanted. It was easier. After that, I conceded to every challenge and every request, because I had to have her affection. And that's what I mean when I say I lost myself.
Conrad didn't speak, allowing Matthew to complete the full answer to the question.
"You're correct. I wasn't the sort of man to have plastic surgery, but I agreed to it because the rewards were worth it. The more I became the man she wanted, the more she provided."
Matthew sat back in his chair, breathing out as if he had unburdened himself. "You mean sex?"
"Is that all you think about, Mr. Neil?"
Matthew had caught him out again, and he could have kicked himself for lack of judgment.
"I'm talking about the rewards from the charity work, which were far-reaching in terms of the publicity for Helena's business. Not surprisingly, my company bosses were also pleased with the attention. There was such a strong link between our products and cancer care, and they quite rightly took advantage of the positive press by sponsoring quite a few of my daredevil challenges. Workmates would make up the crowds cheering me on. To be frank, I think the lads in the manufacturing side were running a betting ring on whether I would die, or at least end up seriously mangled in hospital. I let them down in that regard, but I did earn their admiration. Can you imagine how proud Josh was of his Superman father? It was almost worth it for that alone. I felt like the greatest dad that ever lived. My fundraising isn't why you're here, though, is it? And it's not the most fascinating of subjects. I do appreciate that you are far more interested in my wife's ability to lead me around by my manhood, and why I killed her. Are you not, Mr. Neil?"
Conrad deliberately kept a straight face and maintained full eye contact with Matthew. "You're not getting me this time, you bastard. I'm not going to bite." "I'm still no clearer on why you killed her, Matthew."
"I killed her, but I never wanted to. I know I killed her because I've seen the photographs. My fingerprints and my DNA were over everything at the crime scene, even on the bunch of flowers that I don't remember buying for her. What I do know is that over time I became more confident, and with confidence came more self-assurance that I could keep a woman like Helena. I had the stamina. I willingly accepted her challenges and her rewards, but..." And there is a big but coming here, Mr. Neil. "Don't ever underestimate the pressure to perform. Helena had to be satisfied first and foremost. I was not permitted to orgasm before her."
"Not permitted?" On screen, Conrad's pupils had enlarged. He shuffled uncomfortably in his seat and frowned as he could not help himself from inquiring further.
"Correct. the punishment if I did?
Matthew asked, as if guessing what the man opposite was thinking. Got me with that one, he thought,
and with a circular gesture, he encouraged Matthew to answer his own question.